Charm of Favor, Chapter 9.
When Jesus walked the earth, he was not particularly powerful. He taught and healed and inspired, but it was his death and resurrection that truly changed the world. The world had never really seen that kind of power before, though there were men and demons who coveted it. The only difference is that they did not want to die to make it happen. The ultimate design was to make other men die for it, and all men to pay for it. The greatest methodology for glorifying men to almost godlike power is the invention of religions. The guideline for establishing a religion is always the same. First, you place a man in between God and the individual seeking salvation. Second, you use the true words spoken by prophets as the mantra and require sacrifice from the members to hear them. It's as simple as that. If you want salvation, you must be a member, and to be a member, you must sacrifice something. In the early days of churches, the sacrifice was your crops, your herds, and often your own children. After all, God himself sacrificed his own son. What makes you any better than him? The modern mechanism of religion is politics. The introduction and control of monetary systems gave birth to the newest and most powerful religion, government. The same principles apply, and the exact same methodology is used. You must sacrifice and give money in order to access government, which is the real-world application of salvation. The high priests, skilled in the art of persuasion, have accumulated the wealth of dragons and the power of demons. There is no human analogy for this. There has never been a political organization as powerful or as fearsome as the Democrat National Committee. Yes, there have been tyrants and despots. There have been Huns and kings and Caesars, but there has never before been a religion party that could command armies and navies, buy up priests and popes, and reign with blood and horror on the earth for so long. The oath and covenant to be robed with the priesthood in this organization requires a commitment of the soul. You cannot leave. You cannot even die to avoid your obligation. In return, you will be provided a charm of favor. The laws of men will not be able to hold you. The bounty of all nations will be yours for the taking. The innocent and hard-working people of the world are your sheep to be shorn or slaughtered by your command. In place of joy, you will be provided seemingly endless pleasure. In place of serenity, you will be driven by the dogs of greed who never tire and never stop. In place of love, you will receive virgins and children for sex. In place of salvation, you will receive a long life of power and more wealth than 100 men could spend in 100 lifetimes. For some, the cost of this religion party is too great. For others, the lure is too great, and life is too short to be wasted trying to earn one's way to wealth. Besides, that type of wealth can be stripped away with a single lawsuit by someone who wants it more than the person who earned it. The promise of eternal life is a shiny and sweet-smelling counterfeit of exaltation. Who wants to eat cold rice when one can have a tender and juicy steak with the finest wines? Who wants to heal the sick or feed 5,000 when one can have his or her name put on the wing of a hospital or command the harvest of a nation? The founding fathers of America knew all about this covenant relationship between Lucifer and his children here upon the earth. God told them about it. But he also told them that the differences between wheat and tares were too subtle for men to discern. To them it was not given to root them out, lest an innocent child of God be cut down and burned in the process. Kill them all and let God sort them out, many military generals would say. Many times entire cities, including their children and their animals, were slaughtered by religious command. Entire genetics were permanently removed from the future in one day by Joshua, or in Gomorrah, or in Armenia, under the swords of Islam. And so, America was formed with two great principles as guides. All rights come from God and cannot be abridged by men, and the rule of law shall apply equally to all men. Great men set the standard very early. George Washington served 2 4-year terms and stepped down. That magnificent standard of restraint and honor was trampled by the greed of the DNC in 1940 at the Chicago Democrat National Convention, when a Soviet spy named Harry Hopkins schemed to cheat John Nance Cactus Jack Garner out of his presidency. Roosevelt won 86% of the delegates and was not even on the ballot, while over the convention loudspeakers came the chant, "We want Roosevelt." Republicans retaliated and crafted the 22nd Amendment, which the states immediately ratified, to force powerful men from the most terrible office in the world after 2 terms. Thus, it became necessary to make sure the religion party held the office, and not the man with the title. The religion had to become syndicated. It only needed someone groomed and charmed to lead the way. Like Jesus, this person would be known the world over. He would have enemies, like Jesus. He would be publicly attacked and become a hiss and a byword, like Jesus. He would be revered no matter what happened, like Jesus. Unlike Jesus, however, he would sacrifice everyone and everything, but never himself. He would use and abuse everyone and everything around him. Instead of people being healed and receiving everlasting life, they would hate their own souls enough to kill themselves rather than face him again. And if they would not kill themselves before him, a suitable death would be provided for them. Oaths and covenants for men like this are prepared from before their birth. It does not matter how he comes to mortal life, for a lineage will be crafted for him. If his history cannot be crafted and polished, then his true history will be sealed with blood and stone that no man shall ever discover it until the end of the world. In exchange for this oath, he will be given a charm of favor. His popularity will eclipse Jesus in every dark corner of the earth. And so it was that the presidency of Bill Clinton came to an end. But the DNC was never more powerful.
Although the nation retaliated by electing George W. Bush in November of 2000, the election was close enough that the DNC lawyers would not concede the presidency, but rather buried the election in lawsuits. The office remained in limbo for months after the inauguration. For almost 4 months, it seemed that no one in the world knew who the president really was. Even after the Supreme Court ruled that George W. Bush won the election, the DNC was relentless, and the mantle of the office evaded the shoulders of President Bush. Then, one calm day in late summer, as he sat reading a story to school children, the World Trade Center was destroyed. A hole was blown into the Pentagon, and a passenger jet was blown out of the sky over Pennsylvania. Although millions of people watched some of the events as they happened, or video after the fact, no two people could agree on what happened or who was responsible. The effects of what happened, however, were unveiled as though they had been carefully planned down to the last detail from the foundation of the world. A mighty spell was cast over the entire world that was so dark and so powerful that it blotted out all light and all understanding. Men and women wandered like temporarily blinded victims of a nuclear flash, and when they were finally able to see a few feet in front of them, they found themselves in a new world. The rights that God had given them were gone. The freedom to travel and the right of privacy were wiped from existence. The American government exploded in size and in authority. It was now ready for the next great leader of the party religion to step into the office of the presidency. The DNC maintained continuity and solidarity through the entire process. Candidates who appeared to compete with one another for the same office had made covenants to the same dark power. The winner was the syndicate that spent more than a century preparing to make its move. And it was this power that prepared the next level of leader. By the time the Bush presidency was over, the National Defense Authorization Act had consolidated the most powerful intelligence organizations into an invulnerable overlord of information control. It was Hillary's time to take power, and millions had been spent making sure the superdelegates would ensure her the nomination. The DNC, however, had other plans. They needed a charismatic personality, which Hillary was not. They had raised and groomed Barack Hussein Obama to be the next president. Hillary didn't like it, but she was a loyal soldier to the syndicate. The superdelegates switched the vote in a single week, and Obama was nominated as the Democrats' candidate. A more dismal political strategy could not have been crafted. John McCain had no speaking ability, no platform, and no following among Republicans. Even with the addition of Sarah Palin as his running mate, the Republicans didn't stand a chance against an imam trained in the art of argument and public speaking. Keenly aware of Bill Clinton's popularity among Democrats and his comfort talking about middle-class issues, Barack Hussein Obama worked overtime to get Bill Clinton involved in his campaign for the Democrat nomination. But it wouldn't come without a price. Clinton's then-gatekeeper, Doug Band, issued an ultimatum to the Obamas. The price of William Jefferson Clinton's involvement in the campaign was the retirement of Hillary Rodham Clinton's balance due. In other words, Band was demanding that Obama help pay off Hillary's 2008 campaign debt, at that point about $250,000 in exchange for Bill Clinton's help on the trail. Though top members of the Obama campaign were flabbergasted at the demand and held Band in especially low regard, they hated being shaken down for money by the Clintons, but they eventually agreed to help retire Hillary's campaign debt. They agreed too quickly, however, because there was more to the total cost of doing business with the Clintons. Obama had to agree to make Hillary his Secretary of State for 4 years. He would also agree to protect her, as she intended to set up a pay-for-play operation more aggressive than anything ever seen before. She began within hours of being sworn in by setting up a secure off-site server that would handle all of her digital communications without government oversight or record retention. For years after she left the State Department, the transactions she conducted from that chair remained secret. The syndicate had already set up a nonprofit foundation to which buyers of the favors, approvals, and regulatory assistance could make their payments. She was also able to move $5 billion of State Department money offshore to act as a safety account for her own run for the presidency in 2016. The Clintons' bag man, Terry McAuliffe, was an expert at bringing money into the campaign. He worked tirelessly and loyally to fund the Clinton crime syndicate and was handsomely rewarded when Hillary's brother, owner of Gulf States Capital in Mississippi, put Terry into the driver's seat of an electric car and snapped a picture for the papers. The state of Mississippi granted $5 million to McAuliffe to launch the car company and provide jobs in 2011. He grabbed the money, flew to Virginia, and used it to win the governor's office in November of 2013. He never turned over the first shovel of dirt to build that factory in Mississippi. To this day, lawsuits brought by the state to get their grant back have been fruitless. The syndicate prevents the case from ever coming to court. The schemes to raise money by the Clintons became larger and bolder than anyone could imagine. On July 5th, 2005, Southern Cross Resources, Inc., and Afflees Gold and Uranium Resources Limited announced that they would be merging under the name SXR Uranium One Inc. One of the partners, Frank Gistra, was introduced to Bill Clinton, who was recruited by Frank to accompany him to Almaty, Kazakhstan, to begin on the uranium interests from Kazatomprom. They met with Nursultan Nazarbayev, the leader of Kazakhstan. Mr. Clinton handed the Kazakh president a propaganda coup when he expressed support for Mr. Nazarbayev's bid to head an international elections monitoring group, undercutting American foreign policy and criticism of Kazakhstan's poor human rights record by, among others, Hillary, then a senator. Within days of the visit, Mr. Gistra's fledgling company, Eurasia Energy Limited, signed a preliminary deal giving it stakes in three uranium mines controlled by the state-run uranium agency Kazatomprom. The Kazakh deal was a major victory, and Eurasia did not wait long before resuming the hunt. In 2007, it merged with Uranium One, a South African company with assets in Africa and Australia, in what was described as a $3.5 billion transaction. The new company, which kept the Uranium One name, was controlled by Eurasia investors, including Ian Teffler, a Canadian, who became chairman. Through a spokeswoman, Mr. Gistra, whose personal stake in the deal was estimated at what was considered a paltry $45 million, said he sold his stake in 2007. Several months later, Mr. Gistra had donated $31.3 million to Mr. Clinton's foundation. Frank said in a public statement that he was extremely proud of his charitable work with Mr. Clinton, and he urged the media to focus on poverty, health care, and the real challenges of the world. This type of public subterfuge became a hallmark tactic of the Clinton crime syndicate. Though the 2008 article quoted the former head of Kazatomprom, Mukhtar Jakashev, as saying that the deal required government approval and was discussed at a dinner with the president, Mr. Gistra insisted that it was a private transaction, with no need for Mr. Clinton's influence with Kazakh officials. He described his relationship with Mr. Clinton as motivated solely by a shared interest in philanthropy. As he prepared to make a short speech and collect a $500,000 payday in Moscow in 2010, Bill Clinton sought clearance from the State Department to meet with the key board director of the Russian nuclear energy firm Rosatom, which at the time needed the Obama administration's approval for a deal they were about to make. Arkady Dvorkovich, a top aide to then-Russian President Dmitry Medvedev and one of the highest-ranking government officials to serve on Rosatom's Board of Supervisors, was listed on a May 14, 2010 email as one of 15 Russians Bill wanted to meet during a late June 2010 trip. The representation was again deceptive, because Bill Clinton instead got together with Vladimir Putin at the Russian leader's private homestead. As if to underscore the point, 5 months later, Mr. Gistra held a fundraiser for the Clinton-Gistra Sustainable Growth Initiative, a project aimed at fostering progressive environmental and labor practices in the natural resources industry, to which he had pledged $100 million. The star-studded gala at the Conference Center in Toronto featured performances by Elton John and Shakira, and celebrities like Tom Cruise, John Travolta, and Robin Williams encouraging contributions from the many so-called FOFs, Friends of Frank, in attendance, among them Mr. Telfer. In all, the evening generated $16 million in pledges, according to an article in The Globe and Mail. None of this would have been possible if Frank Gistra didn't have a remarkable combination of caring and modesty, of vision and energy and iron determination, Mr. Clinton told those gathered, adding, "I love this guy, and you should too." As recent as 2009, the former head of Kazatomprom Mukhtar Jakashev had been arrested on charges that he illegally sold uranium deposits to foreign companies, including at least some of those won by Mr. Gistra's Eurasia and now owned by Uranium One. Some of those companies may have eventually funneled the uranium to players like Iran and North Korea. Most people discount the influence of the 2008 recession had on the global economy, but when Americans aren't buying, it slows cash flow down around the world. When heads of state can write checks from their treasuries, the sale can be very lucrative. And after all, who's going to miss a few kilos of uranium? The influence of having the former president there was powerful, but the ultimate goal was to sell the project to the most powerful buyer in the world, Vladimir Putin. At the time, Russia was already eyeing a stake in Uranium One, Rosatom's company documents show. Rosatom officials say they were seeking to acquire mines around the world because Russia lacks sufficient domestic reserves to meet its own industry needs. It was against this backdrop that the Vancouver-based Uranium One pressed the American embassy in Kazakhstan, as well as Canadian diplomats, to take up its cause with Kazakh officials, according to the American cables. "We want more than a statement to the press," Paul Clark of Uranium One Executive Vice President told the embassy's energy officer on June 10th, the officer reported in a cable. "This is simply chit-chat. What the company needed," Mr. Clark said, "was official written confirmation that the licenses were valid." The American embassy ultimately reported to the Secretary of State, Mrs. Clinton. Though the Clark cable was copied to her, it was given wide circulation, and it is unclear if she would have read it. The Clinton campaign did not address questions about the cable. What is clear is that the embassy acted, with the cables showing that the energy officer met with Kazakh officials to discuss the issue on June 10th and 11th. 3 days later, a wholly owned subsidiary of Rosatom completed a deal for 17% of Uranium One, and within a year, the Russian government substantially upped the ante with a generous offer to shareholders that would give it a 51% controlling stake. Uranium One controls 20% of U.S. uranium production. The only way this could take place was if the 9 voting members of the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States approved it. One of the most important members of that committee is the State Department. As a matter of distance from the actual deal, Hillary assigned Jose Fernandez, the Department of State's representative to CIFIUS, to vote in favor. The Podesta Group was on record as lobbying Hillary Clinton and other agency members of the committee on behalf of Uranium One. The Podesta Group is run by Tony Podesta, the brother of John Podesta, who was Hillary Clinton's 2016 campaign manager. In 2010, Russian interests acquired controlling interest in Uranium One. Hillary was then able to solicit more than $150 million into the Clinton Foundation that would act as an international super PAC to slush money through other foundations, most of which were offshore, for political support. Countless FOIA lawsuits and attempts by reporters to follow the money trail were fruitless, as foreign nonprofits do not have to disclose their sources or uses of donated funds. Within 4 years, Hillary was able to net nearly $2 billion for her political operations and to hide all the evidence by maintaining and exclusively using a private server for all her State Department business. The lawsuits and congressional subpoenas produced nothing, as the Clintons refused to cooperate at every turn, while publicly only the corner of the napkin without the bloodstains would be shown. In August of 2015, months before the first primary vote or caucus would occur at the Democratic Party convention in Minneapolis, 33 Democratic state parties made deals with the Hillary Clinton campaign and a joint nonprofit fundraising entity called the Hillary Victory Fund. The deal allowed many of her core billionaire and inner circle individual donors to run the maximum amounts of money allowed through those state parties to the Hillary Victory Fund in New York and the DNC in Washington. The idea was to increase how much one could personally donate to Hillary by taking advantage of the Supreme Court ruling in 2014, McCutcheon versus FEC, that knocked down a cap on aggregate limits as to how much a donor could give to a federal campaign in a year. It thus eliminated the ceiling on amounts spent by a single donor to a presidential candidate. From these large amounts of money being transferred from the state coffers to the Hillary Victory Fund in Washington, the Clinton campaign got the first $2,700, the DNC was to get the next $33,400, and the remainder was to be split among the 33 signatory states. With this scheme, the Hillary Victory Fund raised over $26 million for the Clinton campaign by the end of 2015. The rest of the money went to the state parties and eventually the candidates, including many office holders who are superdelegates. This was just the beginning of the flow of traceable money to them. There was also untraceable money in the form of transportation, PAC ads, foundation grants, education grants for the children going to college, and real estate in foreign countries purchased in their names. Hillary had lost an election once before to a startup nobody named Barack Obama, and she was not going to be caught short this time. The syndicate wanted to make sure every single superdelegate was pledged before the first vote was cast. The fund is administered by Treasurer Elizabeth Jones, the Clinton campaign's chief operating officer. Ms. Jones had the exclusive right to decide when transfers of money to and from the Hillary Victory Fund would be made to the state parties. So if a superdelegate whose state voted overwhelmingly for the other 2016 Democrat primary candidate, Bernie Sanders, switched his or her support to Sanders under the reasoning that she was representing the will of her state, then Clinton's campaign COO would simply shut off the spigot and all that sweet, sweet cash would stop flowing into the coffers of that Democrat party. That would starve out the other Democrats running for offices on the state and federal levels. Not a single superdelegate changed their vote, even in the face of violent protests in state after state. There was no possibility Bernie could win, even if he won the majority of votes in every single primary and caucus. Not only did Hillary's financial bundlers and billionaire supporters get to bypass individual campaign donation limits to state parties by using the apparatus of several state parties, but the Clinton campaign got the added bonus of buying that state's superdelegates with the promise of contributions to that Democrat organization's reelection fund. Superdelegates are supposed to be free to choose the best candidate according to their own beliefs about what is best for the party. But now, many of them will have that choice essentially turned into a dilemma. They can support Hillary and stay in politics, or they can support Bernie and deprive both themselves and their state party of significant funding from the Clinton crime syndicate, thereby ending their political career. Superdelegates who switch their vote to Bernie would lose their money, the many perks of being a member of the syndicate, and any friends they thought they had in their state party. The following is an official list, according to the Federal Election Commission, of the beneficiaries of the Clinton Victory Fund scheme. Keep in mind that this is only the official money that was allowed to be traced by the FEC. It does not include offshore, untraceable money, or money spent on their behalf with issue ads or attack ads on their opponents.